Chapter 8. The Aftermath. The bright morning light peeked through the blinds, painting a pale stripe across the rumpled duvet. Violet stirred, the remnants of a deep and sound sleep, clinging to her like cobwebs. It was just before 9 a.m. the following morning, a Thursday, and Violet was beginning her usual wake-up ritual. The stress from the night before had completely worn Violet out, and when her head hit her pillow, she had immediately fallen asleep, out like a light. Then without interruption, she had slept through the entire night. Now well rested, she was adhering to her usual routine for starting the day. While still lying in bed, she repositioned her pillows so that she was more upright, to facilitate watching the TV sitting on a dresser on the opposite side of the room. Violet grabbed the TV remote, left laying on top of the bed, and a bottle of water left on her nightstand. Still resting in bed with the TV on, she searched to find out what the latest news was about the bombing from the night before. A clear testament as to how horrible the bombing was, every news outlet had full continuous coverage of the attack, and the whole nation was watching. As Violet flipped through the channels, she came across a news station displaying the image of the suspect that had escaped, the same image she helped create. The announcer saying, "Be on the lookout for this man. He is suspected of being involved with the person that carried out the bombing at the Alamo Center last night. If you know this person, or you see him, please contact the police immediately, and do not confront this person, consider him armed and dangerous." Overnight, this image of the bomber's accomplice had been released to the press, and his face was being circulated on every news channel. Needless to say, Violet was impressed, and pleased that she was able to contribute to this manhunt. The news coverage was quickly redirected to a press release that had just started. The chief of police was just stepping up to the mics arranged on a podium, just outside of the Mobile Police Command Center at the Alamo Center. This was the same police officer that Violet heard from during the video conference at the fire station, just the day before. Violet sat up more alert, and listened closely. With a more stressed and serious look on his face this time, the officer began speaking. "My name is James Stiller, I am the San Antonio Chief of Police. Having spoken to witnesses, and reviewing the available video footage, it has been determined that last night, a terrorist wearing a suicide vest, detonated his vest outside the Alamo Center near the main entrance, just as people were beginning to leave the stadium." Speaking strongly and clear, he continued, "This was, without a doubt, a terrorist attack. At this time, we do not know who or what organization is responsible for this attack, but we do believe more than one person was involved. I'm sure by now, many of you have seen the image of the man that we are searching for in connection with this bombing. If you see this man, or know who he is, contact the police or the FBI immediately." Violet was proud to know that her description of the accomplice had been taken seriously and had become a major benefit to the investigation. After a pause and the shuffling of his notes, the police chief resumed the news release. "Now for the sad part, the explosion resulted in the deaths of 9 people, and the serious injury of 67 other people. All of the injured were transported to area hospitals. Of the injured, 8 of them are still in critical condition. Many of the injured have life-altering physical damage. Of those that have perished, 6 were pronounced at the scene of the explosion, the youngest of which was a 10-year-old boy, and 3 victims have passed away at area hospitals." As she listened to the chief talk, Violet was reliving the intense and horrible crime scene caused by the blast. It is unimaginable for any civilized person to comprehend the suffering and the heartbreak that the bomber caused, but she knew firsthand, because she lived it. Having dealt personally with Davy and Mac, and witnessed the actions and emotions of the uninjured at the scene, she understood the depth of the suffering, and that it goes way beyond those physically cut down by the explosion. Like a narrator telling a story, as the chief spoke, he was telling Violet's story. His words were Violet's actual memories, from just the night before. The numerical details he presented didn't come close to portraying how awful it was as it played out raw and unfiltered, but Violet knew. As tears began streaming down Violet's cheeks, the chief continued speaking again, after another sorrow-felt pause. "3 of the people that were pronounced at the scene were some of our own, San Antonio police officers. Officers James Spearman and Stephanie Holt were on duty, and were actively in pursuit of the suspected bomber. They were very close to the bomber when the vest detonated. Captain Juan Perez was off duty and on his way out of the stadium. Captain Perez tackled the bomber and wrestled for control of the detonator when the vest exploded. Juan's heroism was a detail that Violet didn't know until just now. It was inspiring. The chief kept talking, after wiping away a tear. If it were not for the heroism of these police officers, the bomber may have made his way deeper into the stadium. If so, the number of casualties would have been several times greater. The chief raised his voice and shook his fist, while saying, "These officers risked and gave their lives to save others. They are absolute heroes. I promise you, we will find all those responsible, and we will bring them to justice." Although Chief Stiller wasn't finished, and others were yet to speak, Violet couldn't take any more news. She had heard all the bad news she could stand, for now, and turned off the TV. Still teary-eyed, the heroism of the police officers inspired her. Violet was thinking, "What can I do to help? Sitting around my apartment would be a waste of my time. Those officers gave up their lives to save others. Perhaps there is more she could do." In spite of enduring all the violence and sadness from the night before, even though Violet was not scheduled to work today, she was determined to help if needed. She was motivated and decided to head for the fire station. Drawn not just by the sense of duty, but also by the promise of friendly faces and likely some good food. Most of the firemen at her firehouse are exceptional gourmets, and they really know how to eat. Plus, she couldn't bear the thought of being alone right now. Committed to making the most of her day, Violet collected herself and was heading off. Pausing in the doorway, she cast a lingering look at her wedding photo. A soft smile played on her lips as she blew a kiss towards John. Though touched with a hint of sadness, her expression held a spark of determination and hope that she could continue to make a difference. With a deep breath, she stepped out the door. Meanwhile, in Austin, Texas, there was a knock at the door at Mary's home, Dave's daughter, located on the southeast side of Austin, in a neighborhood on Monarch Drive. 9-year-old Michael, Mary's son, flung the door open with a joyous, "Hi, Mac." Mac shared a smile back, asking, "Hey, Michael, is your mom around?" Mac was a very good friend to Mary and her children. They often shared special occasions and birthdays together with the rest of the family. Michael answered, "Yep, come on in." Leading the way, Michael called out, "Hey, Mom, Mac is here." Mac closed the door, scanning the room for any sign Mary knew about what happened at the Alamo Center, or the tragedy of her father. The TV, displaying a paused video game, hinted they might be out of the loop. Everything seemed normal, a stark contrast to the storm brewing inside him. He wanted to check on Mary, and if need be, he didn't want to break the bad news over the phone. Sleep-deprived but resolute, Mac was determined to deliver the sad news in person. Mary, emerging from laundry duty, reading Mac's face, she froze, and she became concerned. "Hi, Mac, is everything okay?" Michael was by her side, and he was excited about Mac's visit. "Mary," Mac said with a somber voice, "I need to talk to you alone." Mary's gaze dropped to Michael, strands of his hair escaping her grasp as she gently ran her fingers through it. "Honey, can you go play in your room for a bit? Mommy needs to talk to Mac privately." Dismayed, Michael frowned. "Aw, man," he mumbled, "let me know when you're done talking." As he trudged towards his room, while the seriousness of why Mac was here filled the air, Michael was hoping to spend some time with Mac, and was disappointed. Mary watched him go into his room, then turned back to Mac. With a tremor in her voice, she asked, "So, what's going on?" Mac hesitated, then gestured towards the couch. "Let's sit down." He sank onto the cushions, inviting Mary beside him with a gesture of his hand. As Mary slowly sat down next to Mac, her eyes were wide open with worry. A choked whisper escaped her lips, "Mac, you're scaring me." She sensed that Mac's unplanned visit wasn't good. Mac was having a hard time getting started, but finally, the dam broke. "Mary," he began, his voice thick with emotion, "I came here because, yesterday, your father and I went to the football game at the Alamo Center. That night, as we were leaving, a terrorist detonated a bomb. It took your father's life." A horrified look came to Mary's face. "What? Are you telling me that my dad is dead?" Her voice was just a whisper as she trembled. Tears welled up in her eyes, blurring her vision as her head dipped down. Mac reached out and held Mary's hand, then said, "I'm so very sorry. Your mom and brother already know. I came here first thing this morning, to tell you in person." After a moment she looked back up at Mac. Her voice raw and crying she asked, "How do you know my dad is dead?" Tears welled up in Mac's eyes too, spilling down his cheeks. "I was there, I saw how badly he was hurt." Between Mac's fatigue and grief, he was finding it hard to speak, but he continued. "An ambulance took him to the hospital, and I went there. Your brother Davy and I went to the hospital together." Mary began to openly cry out loud, with her face wet with tears. She covered her face with her hands, as if to hide from Mac's words. Mac added, "By the time we got to the hospital, your dad had already passed away." Just then, Mary and Mac heard a child sobbing from the hallway. They both looked over and saw Michael standing in the doorway to his bedroom. He had been listening to the bad news Mac was giving to his mom. His face was wet with tears, and very sad. Michael whimpered to his mother, "Mom, can I come over there?" Sitting on the couch, Mary reached out with her arms, "Come here, baby." Michael went running over to his mother and they hugged each other tight. They cried together for a spell. And then Michael looked into his mom's eyes and asked, "Mom, does this mean that we are not going to see Grandpa again?" Mary hugged Michael tight again, and gazed with a blank stare. She replied, "Yes, dear, Grandpa is gone from this world. He has gone to heaven." Mary was just barely able to maintain her composure, as she held and tried to comfort Michael. She was struggling to keep it together, and was both heartbroken and angry. The sadness and grief being forced onto her son by a terrorist was so sudden and unexpected, it left her at a loss for words. Mary knew Michael adored and loved his grandfather immensely. He was Michael's primary father figure, and they were so very tight. A moment later, Nancy, Mary's younger child, walked into the room clutching a doll. Nancy had been playing in her bedroom since before Mac had arrived. Seeing and hearing everyone crying, and their faces wet with tears, she curiously asked, "Mommy, why is everyone crying?" Overwhelming responsibility settled on Mary's shoulders. How could she delicately explain the inexplicable to her youngest child? Mary was struggling fiercely to maintain her own self-control, an attempt to protect and shield her children, but it was a battle she was about to lose, and she was going to need Mac's help. In today's world, with advancements in medical science and preventative care, death has become less familiar, especially for children. In the past, death was a more common occurrence, leading to a greater acceptance of its inevitability. However, medical breakthroughs and safety measures have significantly extended life expectancy, allowing society to delay the inevitable. For Mary and Davy's children, this will be their first experience with the loss of a loved one. They are likely to have many questions about death, grappling with both their own mortality and the loss of their grandfather. While the fear of death is universal regardless of age, the circumstances surrounding Dave's death will make it particularly difficult for his grandchildren to comprehend. The depravity of his murder and the underlying prejudice that fueled it will undoubtedly leave a lasting impact on those who loved him. Dave's other daughter, Jennifer, stationed thousands of miles away at Ramstein Air Base in Germany, had just returned home from a long shift where she worked as an air traffic controller. Unaware of the tragedy unfolding back in Texas, she was enjoying a takeout meal when a knock at her door shattered her quiet evening. Looking through the peephole, she saw a group in military attire, a colonel, a chaplain, and a female sergeant. Puzzled, she opened the door with curiosity. Jennifer stood in the doorway and greeted them, unaware of the news they carried. The colonel, clipboard in hand, introduced himself, the sergeant as a base counselor, and the chaplain. To confirm her identity, he asked, "Are you Jennifer Ella Johnson?" With a suspicious tone, Jennifer answered with a "Yes, sir." She was wondering how they knew her without her first stating it, so it was apparent that they purposely were in search of her, and they weren't just going door to door. A touch of suspicion flickered in Jennifer's eyes as they requested to come in. Trusting her fellow airmen, she ushered them inside. "Come in, and have a seat," Jennifer graciously said. Her first thought was that with the chaplain present, she thought perhaps they were on a mission that had something to do with the base church. She asked, "What can I do for you?" As Jennifer sat down, the chaplain remained standing near Jennifer, his posture, a hint of some need to stay close. As the colonel began to speak, the chaplain knelt down beside her chair. He inquired if she'd heard about the events at the Alamo Sports Center last night. Jennifer answered, with a hint of defensiveness in her voice, saying, "Of course, I'm familiar with the Alamo Center, I'm from Texas. It's not far from my family's home, where I used to live. But I'm not familiar with any of the events happening there this week." Then she added, "I've been on duty since early this morning, and I just got home." As Jennifer glanced at their faces, she noticed a growing sense of unease. They all seemed unhappy, their expressions serious and concerned, like they were holding something back. A knot of worry tightened in her stomach. She inquired, "Why are you asking me about the Alamo Center?" Taking a deep breath, the colonel revealed the devastating news, saying, "A suicide bomber attacked the Alamo Center at the end of a football game last night." Jennifer's breath froze. Jennifer remembered in an instant that her dad was going to a football game at the Alamo Center. After a short pause, the colonel added, "Jennifer, your father, David Johnson, was killed by the explosion." After sitting silent for a moment and just taking in what she had just heard, gradually, extreme sadness began to take over. Jennifer replied, sobbing, "Maybe it was somebody else. San Antonio is a long way away. Maybe you've got it wrong." Tears welled in her eyes, blurring her vision. Jennifer's breathing was quickened, and her heart was racing. Feeling surrounded, Jennifer averted her eyes, looking away. The colonel offered his deepest condolences, while the sergeant moved closer to Jennifer. Consulting his clipboard, he continued, "A Mr. Mac Thompson contacted Lackland Air Force Base, requesting we find you and deliver this news," and Lackland confirmed his story. "Do you know Mac Thompson?" With tears raining, Jennifer began to openly cry out loud, and was barely able to slowly answer. "Mac is my dad's best friend." Feeling surrounded by the awful news from her fellow airmen, she wanted to escape. Jennifer stood up, turned away, and stumbled toward a wall. As she leaned on the wall, the chaplain stayed close. Crying profusely, and unable to see through the tears, she became dizzy and slowly collapsed towards the floor. The chaplain, ever vigilant, caught her fall, then gently guided her, along with the sergeant, into the bedroom. Grief-stricken and disoriented, Jennifer cried out, "My mom, where's my mom? I need my mom." She repeated her cries, over and over, "I want my mom." Jennifer's cries for her mother was an attempt to reach out for some sense of stability. At some level, she was able to rationalize that her mother needed her also. For hours, her fellow airmen offered solace, but she remained weak and utterly distraught. All this way from San Antonio, Jennifer had been struck down by the suicide bomber, with the extreme magnitude of Jennifer's heartache threatening to consume her. Eventually, Jennifer's fellow airmen huddled in the living room, strategizing Jennifer's return to the States. A commercial flight was deemed impossible in her fragile state. The sergeant, a professional counselor, recognized the urgency of reuniting Jennifer with her family. The colonel, resolute, issued a clear directive. A female airman was to be assigned to Jennifer around the clock. The sergeant, entrusted with this crucial decision, would also personally escort her back to San Antonio and into her family's care. Aware of Ramstein's bustling air traffic, the colonel emphasized the need for swift military transport. Jennifer's emotional state demanded privacy, and a commercial flight could exacerbate her condition. The colonel empowered the sergeant to overcome any obstacles, and he reiterated, saying, "We take care of our own. This airman just lost her father to a terrorist attack on American soil. She needs to be reunited with her mother, along with the rest of her family, as quickly as possible. We have to come through for her." They all agreed, and their voices were united with a profound sense of determination in the face of this tragedy. Thousands of miles away, from the heart of Texas, Jennifer has been struck down by the bomber. The common methodology of counting the casualties for a catastrophe of any size is deceptive and grossly inaccurate. Such a simple count misses the grasp of the overall damage. It is human nature that everyone is surrounded by a web of love and caring, a web constructed by the silk threads of humanity. Break any thread, and the entire web is injured, especially those connected close to the break. For Jennifer, the compassion of her fellow airmen will undoubtedly help. But living alone and stationed so far from home, she felt like she was out on a limb, feeling exposed and especially vulnerable. Like a leaf clinging to a tree branch in a hurricane, that suddenly breaks loose, then blown aimlessly through the sky. Jennifer felt isolated, and completely without support from her home. She had been struck down, very hard. The best medicine for her to recover and truly heal will be found with the unwavering love and support of her family, a compassionate truth that Jennifer's fellow airmen also share. Back at the fire station in San Antonio, Violet smiled big with satisfaction. She had just finished a delicious lunch with her colleagues. Violet enthusiastically declared, "Firefighters sure know how to eat." Echoing a well-established department saying, and signaling another one of their exceptionally prepared in-house meals. One of the guys answered back, "You know that's right." A chorus of agreement and laughter filled the room. Just then, the captain entered the lunchroom and was surprised to see Violet, remarking, "Whoa, Violet, I didn't expect to see you here. Today's your day off." Violet explained, "I know, Captain, but I remembered that Pete was cooking a special lunch today, and I couldn't resist." The captain discreetly pulled Violet aside for a private conversation. With concern, and in a low voice, he said, "Sam called me this morning. He was worried about you, and he told me about your difficult time last night." Violet listened intently. "Why not head home, relax while you can, and clear your head? You're back on duty tomorrow." Violet assured him, "Thanks, Captain, but I'm okay, I got this. Being here, surrounded by friends, helps more than staying at home and dwelling on how awful things were last night." The chief nodded, saying, "All right, but if you need anything, even just to talk, don't hesitate to reach out to me." Violet smiled and replied, "Will do, thank you, Rocky." The lunchroom emptied, leaving Violet alone at the table. After clearing her dishes and wiping down the table, she settled back into her seat. Simply spending time with friends and enjoying a good meal had a therapeutic effect on her. It was a welcome distraction from the drama of the previous night. After checking her phone for messages, she decided to unwind by playing a familiar video game. As she immersed herself in the virtual world, she felt a sense of normalcy returning, a welcome relief from the chaos that had consumed her the night before. Violet was focused on her game, when in walked a well-dressed and distinguished man, wearing a suit and carrying a briefcase. He knocked on the doorway to announce himself. Violet glanced up, looking across the table, and then went back to her game. Smiling, the man spoke, "Are you Violet Wheeler?" She paused her game, then gave the man her attention while setting the phone down. "That's me, can I help you?" The man smiled, "Hi, I'm Dwayne Scott with the FBI." He extended a hand for a handshake. "Well, you found me, I'm Violet Wheeler," she confirmed while shaking his hand. He sat down and began removing items from his briefcase, placing a folder with papers inside, and a tablet on the table. Meanwhile, Rocky protectively watched from the doorway. "I figured I'd find you here," he remarked. Dwayne offered his card, "Here's my contact information." Violet scanned the card. With a raised eyebrow, she replied, "So, Mr. Scott, your special agent in charge, you're pretty high up the FBI ladder, to come here to talk with little old me?" A bit surprised, he replied, "Sounds like you know something about the FBI. Call me Dwayne." Placing a hand on the folder and tapping his finger, he added, "After reviewing your file, I felt I had to speak with you directly." Seeing her name printed on the folder, Violet was impressed by the FBI's swift research on her. Dwayne's expression turned serious, and he began to explain the nature of his visit. "Let me be blunt. Due to lax border policies, over just the past few years, we think over 1,000 especially dangerous people have crossed the border into this country. I'm talking about people that may act out in ways very similar to the bomber that detonated the suicide vest at the Alamo Center last night. We know for certain that the bomber's accomplice escaped, and potential terrorist chatter within Texas is rapidly accelerating." Dwayne's assessment raised Violet's eyebrows and got her attention, and even Rocky felt uneasy, shuffling his feet as he looked on with worry. Violet clarified, stating, "Tell me if I understand you correctly, you believe that there are over 1,000 potential foreign terrorists in our country, right now?" Dwayne nodded in agreement. "We know they're here." "My immediate goal," is to apprehend those responsible for the Alamo Center bombing and drag in as many accomplices as I can find. Our country, our fellow Americans are in extreme danger, and I need to know if you will help me." Violet leaned forward, her gaze sincere as she answered, "Absolutely. How can I assist?" Duane opened the folder. It states here, "You were a Colorado State champion swimmer in high school, went to college at Colorado State, joined the Air Force, and eventually served within Air Force Intelligence at Ramstein Air Base in Germany. I'm impressed with the number of commendations you received for someone so young. It seems like success follows you." Violet gave a warm smile. "I guess so. Apparently a lot of people like me." Duane probed, "What was your role for intelligence? What did you do there?" Violet answered, "What I did there is classified. Let's just say that I have special talents, talents that they appreciated." Duane nodded, saying, "The report I have indicates you were the first person to alert stadium security of a potential bomber at the stadium last night." Then he activated a recording app on his tablet and placed it in the center of the table. "I'm recording now. In your own words, tell me everything about last night. Focus on anything related to the bomber, but include everything, even seemingly insignificant details." Violet recounted the events of the previous night, with Duane occasionally interjecting questions. With her memories still so vivid, combined with Duane's inquiries, she was able to recall details she initially dismissed as unimportant. Duane then asked Violet about the car explosion the previous night, leading into another whole line of questioning. Once he seemed finished drilling her with questions about the bombings, Duane retrieved from the folder a sheet of paper, on it the image created by Sophia, the police department's detective and forensic artist. He asked as he slid it on the table towards Violet, "Does this resemble the bomber's accomplice that escaped?" Violet was quick to confirm, "Yes, that's him. I helped the police detective create this image. I got a very good look at him." Duane then walked around the table and sat beside her. On his tablet, he opened a photo file, then handed his tablet to Violet, and asked, "Is that him?" Violet's eyes widened. A moment later she answered, "It looks exactly like him. Where did you get this?" Duane had acquired a photo that closely resembled the image Violet had helped create. Duane replied, "Thanks to the forensic image you and the police created, and the news media, we received a valuable tip early this morning from his landlord. This image was taken a few weeks ago, during the day, by the landlord's security camera. We don't know if it's his real name, but the name he gave the landlord was Carlos Mendoza. According to the landlord, he even has a driver's license with this name on it, and he drives a gray SUV." Violet was impressed. "Wow, you guys work fast." "Not fast enough," Duane regretted. "By the time we raided his apartment, he was already gone and—" Duane was mid-sentence when his phone buzzed, a sudden interruption that drew his attention. After reading a text message, he took a deep breath, his expression shifting dramatically. Rising abruptly from his seat, he began gathering his belongings. "Something pressing has come up," he explained bluntly, his voice laced with urgency. He quickly packed his belongings, his movements efficient and swift. Turning to Violet, he offered a hasty apology. "Sorry, but I have to rush out of here. Thank you for your time, you've been very helpful." Duane added, while pointing his finger at Violet, "You have my business card. If anything comes up, please don't hesitate to contact me." With that, he turned and quickly exited the room, walking past Rocky in the doorway and leaving a trail of unspoken questions in his wake. Violet exchanged a puzzled glance with Rocky. "Well, he sure left in a hurry," she curiously remarked. Rocky nodded with a concerned expression on his face, saying, "Something definitely caught his attention. He seemed urgent to get somewhere fast." With the interview over, Rocky turned and headed back to his office. Violet carefully documented Duane's contact information in her phone, determined not to misplace the information. It was a habit she had developed over the years, one that had proven invaluable on countless occasions. The accelerating chatter that Duane spoke of is often the precursor of something bad to come, like a clue. It's a kind of digital dust that's hard to piece together because it's typically in code and fragmented. When it accelerates, it's a sign that bad actors are on the move and that a climax is coming. At Mary's home, The afternoon sun was settling lower in the sky, casting ribbons of light through the blinds across the living room, where Mary and Mac had earlier delivered the devastating news of their grandfather's passing to Mary's children. Tears had flowed freely, a raw display of grief that left them all emotionally drained. Yet, amidst the sobs and sniffles, Mary had summoned her reserve strength, guiding her children through the storm of emotions, a storm that had threatened to consume them. Curled up together on the worn leather couch, they clung to each other in silence, finding solace in the quiet comfort of their shared grief. But for now, the initial shock had subsided, replaced by a quiet, tearful acceptance. Mac, slumped deep in a nearby armchair, mirrored their exhaustion. The whirlwind of events over the past 24 hours had taken its toll. One moment, his life had been normal, and even filled with fun and excitement. Next, it had been ripped apart by tragedy. Still, he pushed through his own fatigue and sadness, determined to be a tower of strength for Mary and the kids. He recognized that in the coming days, they would all need each other more than ever. Eventually, a sliver of afternoon sunlight found Mary's face, stirring her from the tearful huddle. Rising to her feet, her voice thick with unshed tears, she addressed Mac. "I can't wait any longer," she declared. "I need to be with my mom. There's no doubt she's crushed and heartbroken, all alone in that big house." Her gaze drifted to the children, a fresh wave of worry washing over her face, as she stirred her children, saying, "It's time to get up. We all need to go and be with Grandma, right away. We can't leave her to face this alone." To assure Mary, Mac injected, "I'm pretty sure Davy is still there. He was there when I left. Your mom hasn't been alone." Casting a concerned look at her children, she gently touched Michael, rousing him. "Honey, why don't you go and pack a suitcase? We're heading to Grandma and Grandpa's as soon as we're ready. Pack enough clothes for a few days, all right?" Nancy, her eyes red-rimmed from crying, piped up, a flicker of confusion crossing her face. "Will Grandpa be there?" Mary's heart ached anew. "No, sweetie," she replied gently, "not this time. But Grandma will be there. We're going there to spend time with Grandma, to hold her hand and give her hugs." Committed to providing emotional support for Mary, Mac added, "I'll stay here until you're all packed up and ready to go. I need to head over there too. Abby's been with your mom all day also." Then he added, "Let me know if I can be of any assistance." Mary nodded gratefully. Mac's unwavering presence was a source of immense comfort during this turbulent time. With a renewed sense of purpose, she turned to her children, ready to face the journey ahead together. They would navigate this storm as a family, drawing strength from their love for each other and their shared memories of their beloved dad and grandfather. In future days, Mary would find times to cry when the children were not present. For now, she was focused on protecting and guiding her babies through this tragedy. A little while later, as Mary pulled into her parents' driveway with Mac following behind, they were met with the sight of numerous cars, a contrast to the usual calm. Glancing next door, they saw a similar scene at Juan and Maria's house. Undoubtedly, Juan's family and friends had arrived to offer support to Maria and Andre. The act of driving from Austin had served as a strange sort of therapy for Mary, diverting her attention and at least part of her sorrow. Back home in Austin, the task of packing her suitcase and helping the kids get ready to leave had left her numb. Her mind, a whirlwind of emotions, had found relief in the focused act of navigating the roads. Along the drive, the memories of her turbulent divorce, just a few years back, had surfaced again. Though a painful experience, it had fortified her emotions, sharpening her focus on her family and children. This newfound strength would prove invaluable as she grappled with the loss of her father. As Mary pulled in, Mac found a spot along the curb. Mary's brother Davy and his wife Linda had been there all day, and their cars were in the driveway. As Mary and her children stepped out of the car, they unloaded their suitcases. Mary reached out with her arms open, calling Michael and Nancy in for a hug, pulling them both in tight. As a last attempt to prepare her children before going inside, Mary gently said, "Michael, Nancy, Grandma's going to be very sad, and not her usual self." Speaking softly with a calming voice, she added, "We need to try our best to comfort her, to make her feel better." "What about me?" Nancy asked, with tears in her eyes and a tremor in her voice. Who's going to make me feel better? Her uncertainty was so stunning and innocent, unknowing at the time, her words and this moment would linger in Mary's memory for the rest of Mary's life. Mary squeezed her daughter's hand reassuringly. "I will always be here for you, honey," she promised. "We all will. We'll get through this together, as a family, and we will all be there for you." Another hug followed, Mary's words pacifying her children's anxieties. "It won't be easy," she added, "but with time, the sadness will become small." Max stood patiently beside them, his gaze filled with a silent understanding. Mary and Mac shared a lingering moment of sadness as their eyes met, sharing a silent conversation that seemed to say, "Here we go again." Then turning back to her children, Mary asked, "Are you two ready to go inside?" Michael and Nancy, eyes red-rimmed from tears, simply nodded. Inside, the house was tranquil with quiet activities. Davy's three children, nestled on the living room couch, were engrossed in an animated movie. Davy sat nestled among them, a picture of subdued concern, with his arms around each of the two youngest children. In the kitchen, Abby and Davy's wife Linda bustled around, preparing a simple meal. Down the hall, shrouded in the quiet of her bedroom, lay Grandma, taking a nap in her clothes. As Mary's children walked in, Davy's children jumped up and ran over to them. They exchanged a flurry of compassionate hugs and tearful embraces, without saying a word. In their childlike innocence, they understood their shared pain, a sadness that bound them together, and caringly, they sought to reassure one another. Davy and Mary watched, as if standing guard over the children's reunion, with a mixture of sadness and relief. Once it was determined that things were going well, Davy and Mary's eyes met. It was as if their eyes were silently telling a story. It was a story of heartbreak and sadness over the loss of their father, in a way that only siblings could relate to. Playing together all their lives as children, they shared so many of the same memories, all the same holidays, birthdays, vacations, graduations, and the births of their own children. Now, without any warning, they are forced to share the loss of their dad together. Amid Davy's and Mary's personal sadness, a fierce protectiveness bloomed within them. Like a mama bear protecting their cubs, they needed to help their children get through the death of their grandfather with strength and stability. This was their children's first encounter with the death of someone they loved, a harsh reality that mirrored their own internal struggles. Finally, as if a balloon had just burst, Mary and Davy raced to each other, and they embraced tightly. Together they cried, trying their best to maintain some semblance of composure, in an attempt to not upset the children. But the loss of their dad, stolen from them by a terrorist, was overwhelming. The bomb at the Alamo Center had ripped a chasm through whole families, far beyond the Johnsons. It had not only taken Dave, but had also injured his wife and children, and even his grandchildren, leaving a trail of generational devastation in its wake. The ripple effect of the blast impacted not just Dave's immediate family, but also his restaurant employees, friends of all their family members, and extended relatives. The act, this barbaric projection of evil, had sent a wave of terror through the entire nation, a chilling reminder of the vulnerability we all share.